it was different this time. Welcome back, Motorsport 101.
You're telling me Scott Dixon and Alex Palou had opportunities to win an oval race and lost on a fuel save? God damn. What a crime.
As a matter of fact, I'm quite devastated. But only because the HRC car lost its perfect winning record.
I don't
want to diecast, Devin. Please.
I spoke to Dev about this. She's trying. Is all I will say. We love you, Dev.
I will buy one. There is your sample size.
I will buy one. Absolutely. Welcome to IndyCar from Gateway episode here on Motorsport 101. I'm Dre Harrison. He's Cam Buckley. You probably already knew that already. And this is the last episode in our ridiculous quadruple header block that we've had. And on this episode, we are talking about the end of IndyCar's very hectic triple header. We had the 500. We had carnage in the streets of Detroit again, and this time we had the Bomarito 500 from Gateway, complete with $20,000 extra pyro for your viewing pleasure. And with it, a fascinating race, a lot of rain to interrupt matters as well, some of the best oval drivers in the world bashing wheels. It was a great time, drama for CGR, and in the end, in shocking news, Joseph Newgarden wins at Gateway for the sixth time in his career. On one leg as well. Took a foot out of the equation, and it still wasn't enough to slow him down on his best track. To be fair,
I will hop on one foot. It will be no factor.
To be fair, it was probably kind of owed that one from last year. Thanks, Louis Foster.
Still the wildest commercial transition you or I will ever see.
Again, I still love the backstory behind that, that Will Buxton would later say on Twitter that they were going to commercial on that segment with Newgarden comfortably leading. They hadn't seen that Louis Foster had literally just crashed directly in front of him. Buxton is apparently putting a slice of pepperoni pizza to his mouth as the commercial break starts, and they have to suddenly cancel the ad break and come back because they've cut to Newgarden and he's upside down.
You know, I can relate to this. I feel like many a sporting fan has been halfway through a slice of pizza before something absolutely unconscionable happens under television, and they have to process it with a mouth half full of pizza.
We've been there. We have definitely been there before at some point in our lives where we've had to go through the unfinished slice of pizza.
I will tell you, I'm pretty sure I was halfway through a slice. I don't think it was pepperoni. I think it was cheese pizza when Derek Rose tore his ACL.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
Big Derek Rose fan. Still mad about it.
Understandable. That's fucking brutal. So all of that and much more coming up over the next 45 minutes or so for IndyCar coming up. And, well, as you can find us real quick, we're on YouTube, facebook.com/Motorsport101. If you want to get some video highlights of the show, you can do so on Instagram, Motorsport101Pod and M101_podcast on TikTok. If you want to follow us personally, you can at DreHarrison101 on Twitter, at DreHarrison.bsky.social on Blue Sky. See Buckley917 for Cam on both platforms and the usual bells and whistles. If you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/Motorsport101. $5 gets you access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. As Raptor, Jason, and Kira are doing, thank you very much indeed. And of course, all those details and written articles and much more on our website, that's all available on there at motorsport101.com. Right, without further ado, it was a huge storm hits us from West London. Whew, that's a loud one out there. God damn.
Looking at the same thing outside my window right now.
Oh, it's pissing it down outside. Shit's wild. It's 10:40 p.m. in the UK. It is pissing it down in West London. We've needed this. Without further ado, let's talk about another rainstorm, only this time at Gateway.
First of all, holy fuck, Alex Palou. Full position with a bonus point and over an entire mile per hour faster than the field in a total ass obliteration. It did cool off a bit in qualifying. Still, the shock in the Discord was palatable.
I laughed. I could only laugh when he put that first lap. I was like, 174? What? That speedo's broken.
But when the race started, it was a different story. Palou did dominate the first 46 laps, but a surprise charge further back for Marcus Ericsson had him tearing through the field, passing Kyle Kirkwood, Joseph Newgarden, and Alex Palou in back-to-back laps to take the lead. He and Newgarden would be locked in battle for pretty much the rest of the race. Mm-hmm. Scott Dixon inherited the lead in the middle of a green flag pit cycle, but Palou clipped Nolan Siegel in the apex of turn one, with Siegel going into the outside wall for the race's first caution on lap 55. It was Ericsson who retained the lead through lap 114 for another caution, this time for Graham Rahal in the wall of turn four. That morphed into a 20-lap yellow, which morphed into a red as the rain began to come down. In the middle of all of this, Chip Ganassi gambled their race with both Dixon and Palou when the race restarted by running long until lap 197 for another caution flag due to conditions. When we got back going, Dixon asked to take emergency service, and while Palou seemed like he was going to get a get-out-of-jail-free card, he runs out of fuel 400 yards short of his pit box and loses two laps getting the car refired.
Yeah, it's not just a matter of putting fuel into it. It's not just a matter of putting fuel into the car again. You've got to get all the air out of the system.
Pressurized system all the way through from the fuel tank to the fuel injection rails.
You've got
to
drain the whole thing. That takes time. It took two laps to get Palou refired, and that pretty much effectively ended his race. He would eventually finish in P17.
Rasmussen and Newgarden. Yes, Christian Rasmussen. Remember him? Get into an almighty scrap on the restart with 45 to go. Back and forth with Newgarden eventually winning that fight because initially he did not realize Christian Rasmussen was on the lead lap and they were fighting for the win together.
Of course.
Ericsson takes second place back with 35 to go before another rain caution. When they get going again, field held steady and Newgarden took his second win of the season, his 20th on an oval, number 34 of his career, taking him to the top 10 all time. Tying up with Al Unser Jr.
Well, wow, 34 career wins each. He's joint ninth all-time now on the all-time list. You forget that Joseph Newgarden is 35 now and that he's been around the block a few times. And there's only eight men in history with more IndyCar wins than he does. You forget he's no doubt one of the all-time greats in IndyCar history now. And, I mean, if nothing else, say what you will about what Joseph Newgarden is or isn't in 2026. You put him on an oval, there's probably at least a 50-50 chance he'll win it for you because he's still an oval demon and this was no exception, Cam.
Yeah. I mean, really, he was one of a few because Palou was very strong early on, had a pretty fast car, but it was not amazing in traffic.
No.
But Newgarden and Ericsson just beat the brakes off of one another for pretty much as soon as Ericsson got through the field. He was on a tear in that first stint.
I said it when I watched the race back, as I had it on my Skybox. Unfortunately, this was a really inconvenient race for us Brits. It was a 2 a.m. start.
Night for some fucking reason.
On a Sunday night race that started 9 p.m. Eastern, which is just a horrible time slot. People are getting ready for work the next morning. For us in the UK, it was 2 a.m. and it didn't finish until 5:45 after all the rain delays and cautions came into play. I got up for my work shift at like 6 a.m. and the race had only just finished, which was just crazy. I know IndyCar has no right to give a shit about our international audience. There barely is one, but raw deal for us Brits on this occasion. We can't really complain. We have F1 to a barrel, but still. It's a shame you couldn't get to watch it live, because this was a fantastic race. This was as good a race as we've had all season. Probably the best race we've had in, not named the 500. This was a ding-dong fight. Like, and I say to you, Cam, what I said when I watched the race back originally, that might be the best Marcus Ericsson's looked in IndyCar since he got here. And he's won a 500, and he probably should have won a second.
Yeah, he was
dynamite.
He was easily best Andretti. He was making moves on the inside, the outside, mid-turn, corner exit, you name it. He was on rails. Honestly, through basically pit stops and just where things landed, was unlucky not to win this race. It's just he and Newgarden more or less fought each other to a standstill down the stretch. He could not make any inroads, and Newgarden couldn't get away from him either. Not until really the very end of the race. I mean, he broke Kyle Kirkwood's ankles.
Yeah.
And he's been best Andretti this year pretty much as a matter of fact.
Kirkwood is good enough where if everything lands in his favor, he can win an oval. He won this race last year, let's not forget. But he's still not quite in that super elite territory on ovals yet. Ericsson, at least he could say he has won an Indy 500 doing shit like that. And
this is exactly what he was hired at Andretti Autosport to do. And it's been just, if it has been there, it got taken off the board with the 500 in 2025, or it's been a lot of pain. This was the first time we were like, okay, this is the Chip Ganassi Marcus Ericsson. The Marcus Ericsson that was a threat to win on a given oval, who could clean up if Dixon and Palou faltered, and sometimes even better.
He's in a very interesting place right now in IndyCar. Look at the table. He's ninth on points. He is the second out of the three Andretti's. Will Power has generally really struggled this year, not entirely for his own fault, but the reality is Powell's like 16th on points right now. Ericsson is ninth. He's just had a clean, no shenanigans, oval podium finish. I wonder, is that enough for Andretti to give him a new contract? Because he's a free agent at the end of the year. There's murmurs they might bump up Dennis Hauger as a long-term prospect because of the technical partnership that they have now with Dale Coyne. And Hauger's had top 10 speed on road and street courses on occasion. Ericsson's in a really tricky spot right here. I don't know whether you keep him or not. That is a very... You could apply this, I think, to all three of the protagonists on this podium. You could make a compelling argument one way or the other to keep or throw. I think all three of the men that were on this podium. One of them we already know a decision was made about him going into this weekend. We'll get to him in a minute. Mm-hmm. Ericsson is a free agent end of year. Do you keep him at Andretti, or do you roll the dice on Dennis Hauger? Because that is a very interesting scenario.
I do think Hauger is grease lightning. Speed-wise, like he has taken IndyCar like a duck to water. He's been really, really good since coming in here. Really should have had a great 500 and was denied that via a pit lane speeding penalty. He was on the same strategy that won the race with Rosenqvist.
He was a net third. He was a net third on the road and then sped in the pit lane from what could have been a potential shot at the 500.
Would have been, given the race, the way that race played out. He would have been in the hornet's nest fighting for the win. I just don't know with Ericsson, because it feels like these results are so few and far between, but they do happen. He's always due for one every couple races where he'll show up and he'll go, the Marcus Ericsson that got signed to Andretti, and mm-hmm. not just what has been happening, which is being really underwhelming, especially relative to Kirkwood, who's been devastating on road and street courses, and Will, who, if nothing else, has been fast enough to justify the signing, even if the results haven't come through every possible outcome imaginable.
Yeah, the speed is there with Will, but the results just haven't been. Some of that's self-inflicted, right. Some of that's through no fault of his own. But yeah, you look at Ericsson's results this year, it's all over the place. This is a rundown. Sixth in St. Pete, good result. 17th yeah. in Phoenix, fourth in Arlington. That was a great race from him. Ninth at Barber, 25th at Long Beach, 22nd at the Indy Road Course race, 13th at the 500, 8th in Detroit, and then 2nd here this past weekend at Gateway for 9th overall on points. It's not a bad run. Yeah.
The problem is that when it's good, it's really good, and when it's bad, it's awful. It's the exact opposite of what he was at Ganassi, where it's like, you need a top 10, I'll get you 6th. And if you need a win, I'll get you 6th. It's yeah. like the exact opposite. The floor is not very good. I don't know. If you're Andretti Autosport, there's a legitimate argument for both.
Mm-hmm.
It also does kind of... It for me, the biggest thing is this just what Marcus is? Because that's how he was last year, too.
Yeah. But Marcus didn't have the rub of the green results-wise last year. Also, Ericsson's 35.
Exactly. Like, is this what he is? Versus someone like Hauger, where we know Dale Coyne has better equipment this year, but they are still one of the minnow teams.
Yes, definitely.
If you take Hauger's combo of road course speed and you plug that into an Andretti car, that could be really fucking fast.
Could be very interesting. The other side of the coin, we'll talk about the man who was third, Christian Rasmussen, who went from 19th on the grid to finish third in the end. And again, Rasmussen, I hate Townsend Bell's Sultan of Sketch nickname. It's bullshit, but I prefer our version of Mr. Excitement. Rasmussen, if nothing else, is never dull in IndyCar.
No, never. It's always danger zone.
That man had a save where his car was virtually sideways coming out of turn two, and he somehow saved it. I don't know with that man sometimes. He scares me, but I'll give him this. He is fucking fearless. He will bang wheels with Joseph Newgarden, the best oval driver in IndyCar, and he will give him no quarter.
I just think it's hilarious that Newgarden's like, why is this guy fighting me so hard? He's a lap. Oh, he's fighting me for the win.
Oh, okay.
Although I think that's very emblematic of what Rasmussen has been this year, that Joseph just automatically thought he was a lap down, because Rasmussen has been as awful on road courses as he's been phenomenal at times on ovals.
And he was rewarded, because going into this race weekend, it was announced that ECR has given him a multi-year extension with the team to stay in the 21 car going forward. And I looked at that and I immediately went, hang on a minute. Rasmussen is 22nd in points right now. He's barely in the leader circle. He's 13 points above the cutoff right now, because the man below him right now currently is, unfortunately, Kyle Collette, who's had some horrendous bad luck. He was running 8th in this race until his engine blew.
He is. Tell you what, Kyle Collette is going to be like very... If someone in our community nominated him for Rookie of the Year, I don't know if I'd hand it to you, but I'd hear you out. He has been much better than the results have shown. He is very, very fast on an oval.
100%. Rasmussen got this big extension. And you look at Rasmussen's results. His best finish this year before this race was 14th in Phoenix, the race that he had a very good chance of winning, but he blew it when he drove into the side of Will Power. That was his best result this year. Everything else is 15th or worse. He is awful on road and street courses, and it doesn't make any sense as to why he's so bad on them when you put him in an NMP2 car, he's brilliant. It doesn't make any sense.
Hey, you put Connor Zilich in a NASCAR Cup car, and he looks like a bust of the century. My God, it sucks. Trackhouse is so bad. Back on topic. I don't really get it either, but what is ECR if not all in on the 500 every year, which makes how bad things went this year all the more painful. But Rasmussen knows how to get around there. He knows how to work the ovals.
It's weird in the, and I'll make this argument again a little bit later in the episode, but is this really just the 500 taking that much priority over the rest of the series, where you're effectively signing Rasmussen on a multi-year deal with that much committed money?
Yeah.
Purely for five rounds a year?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Fuck me.
The 500, the Indianapolis 500 rules all. Nothing matters but the 500. The split proved that. The TV ratings keep proving that.
6.6 million watched the 500 a week and a half ago. Slightly down on last year for what it's worth, but still the second most since reunification. Yeah.
And then anyone who decided to stick around as a new viewer was subjected to Detroit the next week.
This race did less than a million. I think it was 960,000 watched this race.
In fairness to this race, because that was also a little down on last year, this was rain moved up, and rain affected, and rain delayed in the middle, and that last rain delay, I mean, we were watching and we were watching it with King, and that last rain delay when it was Scott and Pelot leading, the grandstands emptied out. They thought the day was done.
Yeah, fair enough.
So there is mitigation, but I mean, at best, what it was going to probably match last year, there's no growth here.
Yeah, it's weird because overall they're definitely up. They're like, I think they're 20% up on last year right now. They had a really strong start to the year this year, where they were regularly over 1.2, 1.3 to start out the year. I think they're regressing back to the mean a little bit now post 500, but Rasmussen, like, the thing about him is that it really does feel like he's been hired purely as a 500 specialist. And, you know, Alex Rossi's like sitting there 16th in points right now, looking like a big old bag of mid. They spent big money on bringing him in, and he's given them not a huge amount, but at least he'll give you a decent floor for road and street courses. It doesn't matter. It just feels like it doesn't matter, because Rasmussen is the only thing that's getting that team column inches right now, because he is that spectacular on ovals now. Almost for sheer stupidity.
Yeah, he doesn't know enough to be afraid. It's like we say about Fermin Aldeguer and MotoGP. I mean, let's not forget, Rossi did put the car on the front row at the 500. It wasn't really on him that his month of May completely fell apart. Along with his foot, which is still bolted together, and he's still on crutches.
He's still hopping.
He's still on crutches. When they let the guys out for they let the guys out of the cars for a bathroom break because one of the rain delays was so long. ECR is just in a weird they would feel like the ultimate 500 specialist team if Dreyer and Reinbold didn't exist, right?
Yeah.
But instead, they do run the full season. But it feels like the rest of the season, like, Rossi will occasionally get up into the top 10. He will punch above that team's weight, but it just feels like that's what this team is. It does make sense for me if you're going to sign Rasmussen, if you're going to try and maximize what you are. But also, at the 500, ignore the mechanical disaster that was Rasmussen's race because he had a refueling issue. Rossi was still better than him all of month of May.
Yeah.
If you're betting on someone for the 500, you bet on the guy who's won the fucking thing.
I agree. And then there's Joseph, who's kind of in the same boat. Joseph,
I tell you what, if he only turns left, this man is still nigh on invincible.
Then there's Joseph. Unless
it's a curb.
As mentioned, he's got two wins this year, both on ovals, both on short ovals specifically. Was really strong at the 500 from 23rd to 4th and before that crash happened. He's currently 6th on points. In a contract year, he's 1 point off Pato O'Ward for 5th right now. New Garden's in a contract year. He's 35 years old. Do you keep him?
I think
again,
so.
Again, I think you kind of have no choice.
Well, I would actually say, like, last year for me was, like, the nadir of Joseph Newgarden because he was still very good on short ovals, but the road courses were so bad last year, it was, like, practically unwatchable. Mm-hmm. He's been better on the road courses this year. He's still great on the short ovals. He's 6th in points. And, like, you've got a genuine statistical anomaly out in front of everybody, and then Kirkwood and Malukas beefing hard over 2nd, trying to run him down. Those three are in, like, career years. Feels like every year is a career year for Alex Palou at this fucking point. More on him a little later. To be 6th behind that is not bad, and that's after losing out on any points for the 500 because, A, made a mistake and clipped the curb. That's one of those shit happens kind of mistakes.
Yeah, it's one of those you just don't know until you put a wheel there and, you know, you live with the consequences, and that was unfortunate. But, yeah, if nothing else, he is still the best overall driver in the world. There's no doubt, in my opinion, that he's that guy. Pato O'Ward is about the only... Yeah, he did that with 1 foot. He's still walking around on crutches.
Best Penske in Detroit on 1 foot, too, despite his best efforts.
Despite him openly saying, could you put Felipe Nasr in the car for the win instead?
Yeah, but I have no issue with re-signing Joseph at the end of this year. I think he's been about where Penske is on road courses.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the only mark I can legitimately say against him, Malukas is having a better year, but also David Malukas has been balling out since he got to Penske.
He's been great. He's been absolutely fantastic. He's very put a foot wrong.
Sorry, what about Scott McLaughlin, who in that glorious Marlboro livery?
Mm-hmm.
McLaren, that's how you do it. You got to go with the Day Glow Red. It doesn't work. If you put the papaya on it, it looks like it's been out in the sun too long.
Mm-hmm.
Scott McLaughlin had the freshest tires of anybody at the end of this race, cut up through the field, got into clean air, and then was still getting gapped. That, for me, is the big question mark at Penske, is what the hell has happened to Scott McLaughlin, who got first choice of engineer and basically was the anointed number one going into the season?
You had the right to pull Tim Cindric out of unemployment to manage your car. You are 7th in points. Like, McLaughlin was trending like someone who should have won a title by now. 2 years ago, he nearly did. If it wasn't for Button Gate in St. Petersburg, he's right there with Alex Palou at the end of the season. Like, it's... He was getting better and better and better year on year to the point where you go, okay, this is the one when McLaughlin can win it all. He's regressed in the last year and a half. Hard. What's happened?
I wonder how much that 500 crash weighs on him now. Because that feels like a psychological breaker. And I wouldn't blame him if it did. But it just feels like everything since then has been just messy. It's not even like he's anonymous bad. He's messy bad.
I know for a fact he does a lot of video blogs now on YouTube. That 500 crash hit him hard last year. He said it was the worst day of his life. And
I can believe him.
You know, I've noticed with watching McLaughlin's vlogs, he is very, very self-critical. He's his own worst critic. He is very damning and very harsh on himself when things don't work out. And he'll be the first person to be critical of himself. A part of me respects how open and honest he is about that, but a part of me also gets concerned from a mental health standpoint that I wonder if all that self-damnation is also hurting or dented his confidence. Because
it feels like he's kind of chasing his own tail.
A little bit, yeah. Like, again, he's just been so boom or bust this year. Well, I mean, he was runner-up in St. Pete. That was a pretty good day, all things considered, even though Palou won that race comfortably. Again, Phoenix 8th, not bad, but no, again, Newgon wins that race. You know, you've got the 6th at Long Beach, but again, Palou dominates and wins that race. You know, Malukas was right there behind him. You see my point in that McLaughlin doesn't stand out like he used to in IndyCar, where he was good for 2 or 3 wins a year and was regularly on the podium, had breakneck speed and could get like many pole positions. He had 5 one season.
What did you say? What did you say when he hit 242 flying off down into turn 3 on his qualifying run? He will run less wing than you. Like, he is... he is that mercurial talent who will set that car up basically as an adversary to himself to get the most out of it. And it just, it's like he's gone missing. And that's the last thing I would have expected out of him going into this year with first pick of engineer, with, by all accounts, Penske rallied around him. And what I'm sure Penske would have hoped would have been a major recovery year for them in this series, because last year was an unmitigated disaster. And it just hasn't been. That the bright spots have been everyone else, because Malukas is the star walking in. Yeah. And Joseph Newgarden is still capital everything him. When you only turn left and it's a short over.
Let's talk about your mans for a minute.
Oh, we use the one mulligan per year.
It's weird.
It sucks.
It's like a shit sandwich of strategy from Barry Wonser in the last 3 weekends, where the middle in Detroit, he's brilliant and he gets below the win in Detroit, but it's like the great filling in 2 pieces of bread made out of dog shit because of the 500, where they got it wrong on the weather, and this race where they were wrong on fuel. And Wonser had to apologize to Palou after the fact.
On this one with CGR in total, because Kiffin Simpson ran out of fuel on track. And both Palou and Dixon both end up on this strategy that if we don't get rain, it's either going to be trying to eke it out and save a stop or doing an ultra short fill at the end. Either way, they're trying to play themselves back into win contention. And the rain falls at the exact wrong time.
Yeah.
Either it sticks around and Dixon wins, below a second, and you go, oh, that's a good day.
Yeah.
They got going again. Dixon has to take emergency service. And it hurts so fucking bad. Below is leading, is going to get back onto the same strategy as everyone else. Probably isn't going to keep the lead because he has a longer fuel fill than everyone else, but he's still going to jump half of it, and he's out of fuel. He's out of fuel on pit entry, car dies. And because they basically have to bleed the fuel injection system and reprime it, he lost 2 laps. And basically, so Dixon has a bad day, Palou has a horrible one.
It's a bad beat. There's just no other way of describing it.
This sucks, because like he was putting in the work the previous stint, right? He saved more fuel than Dixon. If that caution falls a lap earlier for the rain, we're good. And it just didn't work. That's racing. It didn't work out that way.
400 yards short.
400 yards short.
That is a bad beat. It reduces Palou's championship lead to 49 points. If anything, it was a blessing for Palou that Kirkwood and Malukas didn't fully punish him on that one. Because they were only 6 and 7th respectively.
It's one of those things, like, It could have been a lot better. It also could have been a lot worse. If there's to take any solace out of this, Happy knows how to putt. Hello annihilated the field in qualifying. He blew them up from orbit. He hit them with the black hole generator from Godzilla vs. Megaguirus.
The speed is there. And like, again, like Polo has gotten good enough on short ovals where he can now contend for the win on them. And that's all he needs to be. He doesn't have to win these ovals as long as he's in the mix like he was last year, where he won in Iowa. He was top five in the other race. He was second in Nashville. Like, if he can keep doing that, he's going to win every championship on the board because he's untouchable on road and street tracks, especially on road courses. On road courses, no one's anywhere near him right now. Like, it's Road America next. And Mid-Ohio after that.
Oh, yes, it is.
Like, Polo was dominant in Road America last year. He should have won in Mid-Ohio last year, but choked. There's no other word for it.
Concentration.
You know, those are two rounds where Polo can win, and if he wins the pair of them, he's going to have minimum like a 70-point lead again.
I need to see. It's ultimately a situation where Polo is... Like, if Polo ends up on the same strategy as everyone else that race, he probably ends up anywhere from 5th to 8th.
Yeah, I think it's a top 8. Yeah. It's a break even. And a break even for Polo at Gateway is a win, because it's arguably his worst track.
Mm-hmm. His worst track, and he got a crushing pole position at it. Like, this one was not ultimately on the actions behind the wheel. Sometimes it just doesn't work out that way. CGR always has one of these every year. I'm glad they got it out of the way of getting too cute with it.
The funny thing about it is, Alex Polo has now been on pole for the last 30 days.
That's another thing. He broke a record. For those who don't know, this is the first time someone has received 4 consecutive pole positions across road courses and ovals since 2000. Mm-hmm. You know who?
Was it Juan Pablo Montoya by any chance?
Might have been.
He was pretty good at this, wasn't he?
He could wheel a car. Plus, he was paired up against Kimi Raikkonen.
It's not bad. I mean, one of the fastest F1 drivers you've ever seen on raw pace. But
Kimi Raikkonen on Michelin still thrives anywhere, unless it's the Nürburgring.
Pop. A rough day for Polo and CGR, but not the end of the world, I think, is the fairest way of describing it. Could have been worse.
The perfect win record on the HRC car. This is a disaster.
There's one more point I want to get into as well, because for those who missed it on over the weekend, and understandable given the lack of coverage it gets, but the Indy Next race was an all-time classic. A ridiculous win for Miles Rowe. Who's turned himself into a real oval specialist over in Indy Next. He originally, I think, qualified in 6th. He was sent to the back for a disqualification, had to start from 24th on the grid, came all the way back, beat Lockie Hughes over the line, and actually led the most laps in the race despite having to start from the back of the grid to win in the Indy Next race. About as dominant an oval performance as Indy Next has ever seen. And it immediately got a boatload of people talking. Specifically, got Will Buxton talking. Now, Will Buxton, for those who don't know, not only does he host IndyCar's coverage, he also hosts the Speed podcast that Fox brought back. They brought back the Speed brand name specifically for this podcast, alongside the excellent Kevin Harvick. And he gushed about Miles Rowe's performance. He called him the driver of the week. He got that award because the fans also voted him for driver of the week, because the IndyCar fans rolled up in force to promote Miles Rowe. I hate to be the black guy to pour water on this because someone has to around here, because Buxton went hard on this call to say that we got to get him in the 500. We got to get him in the 500. He's that good. And I'm like, buddy, do you actually watch Indy Next every week? Or did you just see the headline and went, oh, oval guy? put him on oval. Because
I'm going to let you cook on this section because I need to fully admit myself. I really don't follow Indy Next all that much, other than when I'm at the track, like at Milwaukee.
Yeah, like, and I'll take this one because I do watch Indy Next where I can, and I do watch most of the races. Like, a lot of people wanted to say that criticizing Miles Rowe means you're racist. There's a lot of very bad faith arguments on both sides of the aisle made about Miles Rowe. And let me lay out some facts here. First and foremost, it is Miles Rowe's third season in Indy Next. Typically speaking, if you're in year three in Indy Next, you're not going to make it. That's just the harsh reality of it, because typically the person that leads the championship goes on to dominate. We saw it before with people like Louis Foster a couple of years ago, who basically went unbeaten after the month of May, essentially. He ran house. I think he won 9 times that season in Indy Next. That's why he got the job at RNR, because he was dominant in Indy Next. And that's typically how it goes. You look at the standings right now in Indy Next. Miles Rowe is 15 points after that win. And don't get me wrong, he had a very good Detroit race. He was second in that race as well. So he's had he did a nice couple of results. He's gone up to 15 points. 3 of the 4 men above him, because like Indy Next is having a great season right now. They've got 3 rookies within 5 points of each other at the top of the standings. It's a genuinely brilliant title fight between American Nikita Johnson, a familiar name, Enzo Fittipaldi in second. You might remember from his Formula 2 and Formula 3 days. And Timothy Tkaczyk, who is Poland mentioned. What's up, Jason? And in third place right now, having won earlier in the year at IMS. They're all rookies. And fourth place, Max Taylor, is a rookie in all but name, because he did exactly 4 or 5 part-time rounds last year. And he's going into basically what is year 1.5 for Max Taylor.
Right.
And Lowe is 1 point above the Argentinian Alex DiTullio, who won a race earlier this year in Barber and was taken out from the lead in the other by Max Taylor. By all accounts, Rowe should probably be 6th in points. The point I'm getting at here is that so many people want motorsport to be a meritocracy. We all know it's not. And we're not stupid. We know that it's a game of privilege, it's a game of resources, it's a game of money, and it's a game of getting your foot in the door by any means necessary.
What is Mark Donohue's famous book called?
You tell me.
Everyone should read it. The Unfair Advantage.
Yeah.
If you want to know what racing is about in a single book, go seek that out. And that title couldn't fit better if you tried.
I need people to chill on this, because if you want Miles Rowe to race in an Indy 500, you are doing so in ignorance of the meritocracy that so many people want their motorsport to be. Miles Rowe is in his third year in Indy Next by comparison, and he's 26 next week. Mate, the window is closed by all accounts, and it sucks because I want Miles Rowe to be an IndyCar badly. He's a Jamaican-American. He's a genuine breath of fresh air. He's had a lot of very positive promotion from IndyCar and beyond. His Team Force Indy has been featured on Sky Sports F1 or before for Black History Month and for the Black Lives Matter movement. He's an important figure in making motorsport a more diverse place. Lewis Hamilton gasses him up on Instagram every time he wins a race because he pays attention to Miles Rowe's results. This is good stuff. But I also think it's ignorant if we ignore the greater picture of what Miles Rowe is at in Indy Next right now. And I think a lot of very intelligent people who know what that situation is are burying their heads in the sand over this, and I don't think it's fair. And it worries me because what happens to the next Miles Rowe? For those who don't know, Miles Rowe got this opportunity in Indy Next with another black driver being shoved out of that team. It was Ernie Francis Jr. You may have heard of that name. Had a cup of coffee in NASCAR for a little bit, raced in the SRX series as well, a little while. Actually won a race in SRX as well. He was a talented driver in his own right. He was shoved out the door. I don't think Ernie Francis Jr. races professionally anymore. And if you know Miles Rowe well, he's had a lot of funding, two big checks from Will Power, who saw the talent in him when he was karting, and Roger Penske himself to keep his career alive when he was at USF 2000 level, the third tier between Indy Next and IndyCar. When the next Miles Rowe inevitably comes along, and I say inevitably because it will, I have hope that it will happen again. And just to clarify from Kira as well, he's in the Lamborghini, like Ernie Francis is now in the Lamborghini Trofeo series now.
Oh no.
We got to get something. Thanks for that, Kira, in the chat. This is what worries me. When the next Miles Rowe comes along, are they going to get checks and funding under the table from the series to promote them? Is that person going to get pushed to the moon? And more importantly, should that person get pushed to the moon? Because many people would call that unfair. This is the problem. I feel like Miles is being used as a diversity stick for a series that doesn't deserve the credit. Like, IndyCar doesn't talk publicly about its diversity program. It will mention it briefly every Juneteenth, which ironically is only a few days away as we record this on June 10th. But what's the path towards the next one? What's going to happen? What's your diversity program going to be? Are you going to have something foundation-wise in place down the road? Because I don't think Miles is going to make it, is the honest assessment. If you looked at the situation, third-year guy, fifth in points, being beaten by a bunch of rookies right now in the most stacked Indy Next rookie class we've ever had. You know, this rookie class is good, really good. Nikita Johnson,
like the best we've had in a little bit in American open wheel racing.
Yeah, four genuinely exceptional rookies in Johnson, Fittipaldi, Kukarczyk, and Dettulio. They are all really, really good. Three of these dudes could be full-timers next year, and I'd have no complaints. Max Taylor is also really... Max Taylor's 18. He's really goddamn talented for his age. Rowe's 26. Rowe's a year three guy. His window is come and gone. And I think because people don't follow Indy Next, I fear that people are going to be ignorant to that knowledge and then promote someone who otherwise wouldn't be deserving of the opportunity. And somebody else who is more talented than him might be denied that opportunity, and that would suck. And it sucks because I don't want to say that about a fellow black driver, but someone's got to be honest about the situation. Because nobody else seems to be right now. And it's people that are mentioning this are being shut down or being told to fuck off on social media, and I don't think that's fair. These are all just facts that people are pointing out, and the pattern of behavior that we've seen when it comes to how IndyCar generally promotes people from Next. The last three-year guy to make it was Jacob Abel. And I love Jacob Abel as a human being, great guy, fantastic ambassador for the series, but he wasn't good enough to make the top flight. That's just the harsh reality of it. He was.
What do we say about driver? Like, the first thing we say about them as a driver is what a nice person they are.
Mm-hmm.
You prefer them to all be nice, but there's got to be you got to have the ability in there as well.
Another Dalton Keller
that move.
Yeah,
exactly.
We loved Dalton Keller when he was in the series. He was an intelligent, lovely guy, spoke to fans all the time, was quite a universally well-liked figure for how open he was with fans and the fact he gave back to the series, but ultimately he wasn't good enough to be there, and we all knew that. And when the funding ran out, he was gone. Kira puts sums up in the chat quite well. Miles had the unfortunate issue where he got into the sport too late, rushed through some junior categories to try and be there at an appropriate age, and it just sucks. And there's no shame in getting to next and not getting further. I wish more people were accepting of that. And if anything, that should point out the diversity issue that American and motorsport across the board has. Miles Rowe shouldn't be 26 in his third year in Indy Next. That's an issue. Because he got into it late. Why did he get into it late? Because he didn't have the opportunities when he was younger. That's the point. If he was 3 or 4 years younger, he could be a three-year guy and he'd have a much better chance of making the show.
He's a solid driver out of the timeline.
Yeah. That's a big problem. I had to get that out there because I briefly mentioned it in my DRR as well. And I think I know Will Buxton talks a good game and I know he means well. I don't think he was ill-intended. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt on this one. I don't think he was doing it to be cynical. I think he was doing it out of excitement, and understandably so, because it was an incredible performance. No one is taking that away from him. But I feel like it's also raising a lot of ignorance towards the bigger picture of what this is. And I feel like that had to be clarified and explained. Because it's awkward and it's difficult, and there needs to be more conversations on that level in good faith about it, because that doesn't seem to be happening with Miles Rowe. And I find that unfortunate. Right, IndyCar is back in a couple of weeks' time at Road America. Love me some Road America. Hell yeah.
Love Road
America. Please and thank you. My favorite track on the IndyCar calendar. I love Road America. It's going to be great. Get your brats, get your sailor talks in. It's going to be a good time.
Cheesecake.
We'll be back. Cheese curds. Oh, yes, cheese curds. We need some in the UK. Yes, cheese curds and brats. You'll love to see it. We'll be back for that in a week or so's time. Next time out here on the Viscerary Podcast, Formula One is back for the, Jack's notes, Barcelona Catalunya Grand Prix. Rolls right off the tongue. We'll cover that then. Until then, I've been
driving. Oh, yeah, there's some race on a country road in France this weekend, too.
That, too. We'll be there for that, too. We'll see you then. I'm Andre Harris, and he's been Cam Buckley. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you next time. Sayonara.
You know, maybe this is the sacrifice for getting the diecast straight.
Suffering, it builds character.